Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, everybody, welcome to another edition of Inside College Soccer. What's up, Ian? How are you, man?
I'm good, buddy. I'm good. Just coming down from our recent win in MLS Cup final with Galaxy. So we managed to do it, man. It was a pretty fun experience again.
Right on. Well, I'm excited because we're gonna get a lot of the public. I hate to say it, buddy, you're getting old enough now that those of us who followed your career are probably dying off or retiring or something. But you, dude, we've been following you, my family, for forever, since the Premier League started. And my son was a goalkeeper. I was a goalkeeper and a goalkeeper coach. So you were of particular interest to us and the pathway. And although you did it much younger, you know, my son decided he wanted to kind of do what you did, and that was to not go directly to college. And he took off over to England and tried to repeat what you did, just wasn't nearly as talented as you were. And so I want everybody to get to know you a little bit. First of all, everybody out there, you can find Ian at ianfoyer.com. That's F-E-U-E-R is his last name. ianfoyer.com, camps, appearances, clinics. And then he's also a movie star. You got a movie coming out, don't you, brother?
Yeah, it just dropped. Everybody go see it. It's a fun movie. It's called Werewolves. I play the werewolf. And I even did the stunts in the movie, like jumping onto trucks and getting hit by cars and jumping off buildings. So I played about, 75% of the werewolf scenes. And it's just something that I do on a little bit on the side. I played the Predator in Alien vs. Predator as well. Yeah,
but you were also in Kicking and Screaming with Will Ferrell, right?
Yeah, my buddy and I, we were the soccer coordinators, and I even appeared in it a couple times. There's a scene where they kick the Pele kicks the ball into the stands, and if you look in the goal in the background, that's me, in goal. But yeah,
did you actually get to meet Will and
oh yeah, talk we worked, a little bit? I was on set every day from 6 a.m. till 6 p.m. Will Ferrell, Duvall, all the actors, they were great. So it was a great experience. Will's a
that's cool
guy. Hilarious guy, great guy.
Well, Alien versus Predator, I remember seeing that one, and I had no idea that was you. I just wasn't paying attention to know that was you.
Fully covered. Yeah. Same with werewolves. You wouldn't know until I tell you. But yeah, it's something that requires, they're looking for people that are, really tall, kind of more of a basketball build rather than a football build, American football build, just so you can run around, put the suits on, wear the mask, fly around, do, athletic stuff. And they like athletes because there are moments where you have to really get mentally into a zone because it's awkward as hell and you're not comfortable. It's claustrophobic. You got these tight masks on. You can't see. You got to run around, bungee cords hanging off you and stuff. So, but I enjoy it. I enjoy it. It's fun.
Was it a little bit easier in Werewolves because the technology had come forward a little bit, or was it still about as awkward?
No. When I did Predator, that was the times where practical effects were slowly kind of going, dying off, and movies were going into CGI. And what happened was people got kind of sick of the CGI. There's no real feel to it. It's so perfect that, it's like music back in the day when you hear the record scratching. There's something to that makes you feel more, in tune with the music. So when we did the Predator, it was actually the same suit when we did Werewolves. They just adjusted some of the things, obviously, added hair to it, but it's the same kind of suit. So basically, it's kind of like a wetsuit, really thick wetsuit that you put on. And then the helmet is what is most difficult because that thing is tight. You can barely see. It weighs a lot of Weighs about 30 pounds, and you know, you're doing scenes in the rain, and then all of a sudden 30 becomes 40, and you know, but werewolves is a little tougher, because werewolves is more hunched over, so the mask then starts pushing on your neck a little bit more. Predator was upright, and you know, bulls and you know, strong. So, but they were tremendously difficult movies to shoot, but at the same time, tremendously, you know, satisfying and fulfilling. So, to say, you know, it's there forever. Like, you know, I played the Predator, and now, you know, Werewolves came out. It's in theaters right now. Fun movie. It's kind of like the Purge movie meets Werewolves. So it's good. It's got a little bit of everything, but it's action packed. So it's good.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it. I've heard it, talked to a couple guys that have seen it, and they said it's an edge of the seat movie.
It is.
It'll keep you going from the beginning.
Yeah, it is. It's 10 minutes of buildup on the storyline. And then after the 10 minutes, it's kind of just werewolves all over the place. And what was cool is this, most werewolf movies, they usually just have one werewolf and it terrorizes everybody. This one, there's a pack of wolves. And so it's good. It's good. Yeah.
That's great. And you mentioned music, man. You also make music, right?
Yeah, well, I don't make it. I mix it.
Mixing.
So DJ. I grew up, my father was a musician. My brothers are musicians. And so it's in my blood. And my style is, I love everything from, you know, classical, jazz, Motown to metal, to hip hop, to house music, electronic music. I mean, there's nothing I really don't listen to. So I picked up DJing when I was about 12 through my best buddy, Aaron. He was a DJ, and I kind of messed around a little bit with it. And now I'm, you know, DJ is a strong word. I mix music, and I'll do my buddy's 50th party, or I'll do a house party or a pool party or something, but I don't really have a Vegas residency yet. So that's what I'm working on.
So you said music's in your background. So what did your dad do? Did he do music for a living?
Oh yeah. Yeah. He was pretty famous. So I grew up in Vegas. My dad's from New York. My mom's from Canada. They met in Vegas. My dad was a musician for basically everybody in Vegas from like 1965 to like late 80s, like early 90s, you know. So he did Elvis, Diana Ross, Frank Sinatra, every single person that went through Vegas. He was a keyboard piano player. I grew up, you know, picking my dad up at an Elvis show, or you know, Paul Anka, Diana Ross or something. And it was pretty fun. And my mom was a showgirl, so they met in Vegas through that. So it was crazy times. Yeah,
that's amazing. So how long did you spend your whole youth in Vegas before you took off overseas? How did you get involved in soccer?
Well, so I was 15 when I left Vegas. Then I moved to California for 1 year. And then after that, I moved to Europe at 16. Soccer was interesting. I was living in Vegas and just riding my bike around my neighborhood. And I met this buddy of mine, and his name was Anthony Spilatro. We became really good friends. And then, you know, a few months later, he joined a AYSO soccer team, and he's like, "Hey, you want to join our team? We need players." And I was like, "Sure." I was never played, you know, in my life. And, I just started playing. I was like left back or something, and just Bambi on ice. I was tall and awkward and whatever. And the coach goes, "Hey, get in goal." And that's kind of how it took off. You know, so I got in goal, and immediately I loved the physical side of it, because I was a very aggressive goalkeeper when I played. And I loved the physical side of it. So I immediately, you know, loved the position. Little did I know that Anthony Spilatro, my buddy, his uncle was the famous mob boss, that the movie Casino was kind of made. It's a Hollywood version. Obviously, it's not like a full, you know, documentary. Here, but the movie Casino was based off Tony Spilatro, the mob boss. So his sister's son was my best friend. Yeah, crazy, right? I know.
When did you realize what your friend's dad did for a living?
It was I realized it when my buddy and I were playing Nerf football out front, and the police came to the door of my buddy's mom, which was the sister of the mob boss. And they were there to say, "Can you come to the, you know, play wherever it is they go to identify the body?" I was actually there that day. So the police knock on the door. They tell her what happened. They say your brother has possibly been, you know, murdered. And, you know, she has to go and she like collapsed to the floor, started crying, you know. So that's when I was kind of like, wait, what's, you know. But before that, I kind of had, I guess I was naive, but it was like there was always once in a while she might have needed protection or something. And there would be a couple heavy, full on just, you know, Italian typical, how you doing, you know, sitting there chopping, you know, garlic with a razor blade, just, you know, kind of protecting the house for a couple days or something. So, but I would walk right past them and go grab a can of Coke or something and, you know, go outside and play Nerf football again. Oh. I had no, you know, no, you know, and I think my parents, funny enough, when I asked them, like, they're, yeah, we knew all the time. I was like, so you let me, you know, play there? And they're like, that's the safest place to be. Like,
that's true.
No one's messing with those guys. You know what I mean? So, it was kind of crazy, you know. And then after my AYSO career, at around I think 9 or 10, I joined a team called the Generals, which was a club team. And back then, a club team was basically you get a dad to coach, and you get a bunch of players, and you know, you join the league. There was no club with there's 15 teams and all that, so it's just like one team. And my buddy Aaron Griffith and I, we were best friends and just wanted to be pros from age like 8 or 9. And we joined this team called Generals. And his dad was actually the coach, Larry Griffith, who was kind of my man. He helped me so much achieve what I did. He invented this ball machine back in the day, and it was the size of a U-Haul truck. It was massive. But yeah, he would take me out on a Saturday and just shoot the balls, you know, and it was just make the save. There was really not a lot of technique going on. But man, I figured it out, and I would go out for hours, and it would be 100 degrees in Vegas, and I still would go out. I'd bring lunch, go back out, you know. So I was pretty much dedicated from the second I started. And if I do commit to something, it's pretty much all or nothing. So this was all of it, you know.
You know, that's really interesting. Same way that I learned to goalkeep, there was no training. I think the first training I got was in high school, and my coach was a track coach, and he went to some kind of a clinic because he came back on Monday and said, I've got like 5 drills I want to put you through. And that was all the training I ever had in my career. And yeah. For me, I'm curious if you felt it was the same way. For me, it was almost better forcing me. It definitely made me a better coach later on, yeah. But forcing me to figure it out for myself, what worked 100%. For me was yeah. better than somebody telling me what to do. And then me trying to copy their style and all of that. How did you feel about that? Just having to be forced to figure it out.
The same. I agree. I feel it was thousands and thousands of reps, and you do one and you go, wow, that hurt. Okay, well, let me try this. And you go, that hurt less, so that must be better. You know, and you figure it out. And I think sometimes that's a better way of learning. I think now I truly feel we overcoach. It's an epidemic. I think we're so like, we're basically creating robots. You know, and I think that, yes, we do need tactics. Yes, we do need technique. Of course, don't get me wrong, but you always have to have a balance. You have to have players, you have to give them the ability to be themselves. Like, what if it, you know, age 10 or age 8, someone told Lionel Messi after he tried to dribble and screwed it up, don't dribble anymore. You need to pass. It's like, you teach them how to dribble, you know, so it's, we have to create creative players. And if you look at soccer these days, like the highest level, it's so programmed. It's starting to get a little bit hard to watch. You know, there's no balance. There's no, I find there's no more soldiers in the game. You know what I mean? It's all just pretty, like, you know, and I'm just like, I want a little bit of both, you know, I want a little bit of both.
Yeah, that's, you know, so many stories that go through my mind about it, that sounds so familiar to the way you were raised. And, you know, I know when I started coaching, my son said mm-hmm. to me after he'd come back from England and coached in college for a couple of years and was doing all right. He said, you know, I've thought about the way that you trained us and the goalkeepers. And we had a lot of that would have success. I had Lindsey Dickerson that was at Stanford, won a national title. I had Ali Kirchner that I coached who ended up at Duke and was in the finals against Stanford, ironically. And then my son's career. And he said, sometimes the way you coach is so, you're so rigid in the way you think that when a player gets to another coach, dad, they struggle. with that other coach because they have a hard time adapting. And I thought, I'd never thought of myself that way, Ian. I had never thought about being rigid because I always told players that, look, this is your way. I don't care if you keep it out with your butt. I don't care how you keep it out. Your job is to keep it out of the net. But if you give up goals doing it your way, you're going to have a problem. Then you're going to have to do it my way. But you have to have your own individual style as a goalkeeper and your own way of seeing the game and and getting the job done. Would you, was that your experience too?
100%. Yeah. I mean, like I said, the way I coach now is the same. It's there's a skeleton we work off. And then there's times where a kid will, I remember when I played, I did that. I don't even know how I learned it. The Kasper Schmeichel chest.
I guess that's a handball technique when they play handball. It's a Danish handball technique, I guess.
Yeah, I did it once as a joke. I was like, okay. And then I tried it. And then all of a sudden I started doing it. And no one taught me this, right? No one taught me this. It was way before Kasper Schmeichel because Kasper wasn't even born. And my coach looked at me and goes, dude, what are you doing? I went, I don't know. He goes, but you haven't dropped one yet. I know, it's kind of weird, right? I didn't do it for long. Like, it was just kind of like a brief spell where I kind of tried it out. But it was kind of weird. And I was just like, okay. And he's like, but the second you drop it, I'm going to be on you. He goes, you know, use your hands. Yeah. You know? And obviously, I only did it for like a month or something. But it was kind of fun, you know. So, you know, we got to create individuals and within a certain structure. And like you said, if they start leaking goals because of it, then you readdress it, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing I do I start with the new goalkeeper, Ian. I always incorporate the ball in my warm-up. I've always been that way, and I always start out slow so I don't hurt anybody. I'm not telling them to fly and die, but I always incorporate the ball. And if I can just see them moving across the face of the goal and then me taking a shot, and I even have to hit it that hard back the way they came, I can see they didn't set their feet in time. You know, their feet are still moving. And I'll tell them, today is the only day I'm going to make you 100% better with one thing. And that's it. Just set before I strike the ball. Once I get that athletic balance and get them in a forward position and coming forward, Ian, and getting them set in time, after that, I'm just trying to figure out what their how kinesiology, how their body mechanics are going to work for them, because you get these keepers that are like you, long and lanky, and you get one that's short and stocky. And if you're trying to get a short and stocky guy to do what a long and lanky guy does, and I was dead in the middle at 5'11", my son was 6'1", neither one of us was big or athletic. We each had our own styles because of our bodies, because I couldn't do what Ian does. So how can I keep the ball out like Ian does without being like Ian? And I think you're right. I think we're creating, when I see coaching sessions where a coach is coaching 13 keepers at a time and trying to get all 13 doing exactly the same thing in the same way, almost rhythmically, almost like the Cruyff technique method. Korver, not Cruyff, technique method, where you're trying to get everybody to be little robots. I think it causes problems for keepers, especially later down the line when they're 10, 11, 12, 13. Yeah, they are kind of all the same. But once that growth spurt hits in at 13, 14, 15, some not till 17, 18, each one's going through their own awkward growing phase. And I think a good coach knows how to see that individual and then make help that individual make their own adaptations, right?
100%. And I think when I first joined Galaxy in 2007, previous to that, I had done thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of personal goalkeeping coaching, as well as small group and camps. And I've done all this development, and having a kid, you know, my first lesson that's age 8, and then my next lesson, a college kid, and then my next lesson, a 14-year-old. And then, so having all of these different keepers that, like you just said, you have to find out what works for them. And maybe you adapt the drill a little bit, you adapt the session a little bit to accommodate them. That helped me become, from the first day of joining Galaxy, where the keepers were like, oh, okay. He's not just hitting balls at me. He's not just hitting balls. He's not just maintaining. And I feel that helped me go into the highest level in this country and be able to still teach. whether it was the full men's national team, the women's national team, I could still teach them and get them better by, like you said, understanding what makes them work. It's not about me anymore. It's about what helps them. And I feel when I get a keeper, the same thing. 90% of mistakes on shot stopping are you weren't set. And it goes all the way to the top. I mean, you see the top keepers in the world, they weren't set. And
yeah,
you can focus on that. Oh my gosh, your athleticism, your everything else, your talent can come out. But if you're not set, it's tough. And that's on the shot stopping topic, obviously. So yeah, like you have to be able to, as a coach, understand it's not about you anymore. It's about getting them better. And I think too many coaches, not too many, there's a lot, but a lot of them are all about them. And it's look at me, and it's just, oh, look at me, I'm killing the keeper. And I'm just like, well, okay, well, anybody can do that. You know, and you know, not many can find the finer details and really, you know, adapt to what will help that keeper become better.
I think it was the great Franz Hook who said to me one time, he says, there's goalkeeper coaches and there's goalkeeper trainers. Mm-hmm. And I was a young enough coach. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, look, the trainers, they know all the hoops and the circles and the tricks and the hit from that, and they can smack balls. He says, but a coach can see the individual and they can see their strengths and weaknesses and they can help that person become better. And I said, oh yeah, I want to be a goalkeeper coach. I don't want to be a trainer.
Right. Yep. A trainer is, like you said, it's just, you know, it's, we can just jump over stuff and fly. Coach is more, and again, the mental side, that's where I kind of pride myself on is the mental side. It's understanding what they're going through mentally and pulling that out and getting them into a positive state of mind. Cause I've played there where I was just low in confidence, not trusting myself. And I would tell people this and they're like, are you serious? You just had a great game. You know what I mean? And the mental side is so massive. And that's something that I think will be my next, I guess, venture or phase of my coaching career is going around and, you know, doing seminars and that on the mental side of sports and goalkeeping, especially because it's such a mental position.
Yeah, people don't understand out there. So for the parents who maybe have kids and that are goalkeepers and or coaches that weren't goalkeepers. And it's always interesting to me, by the way, Ian, talking about coaches that weren't goalkeepers, but that when I can't imagine that a head baseball coach knows zero about pitching or throwing a ball. And I can't imagine, maybe it's true, that an American football coach knows zero about being a lineman or zero about being a receiver, zero about being a quarterback. But yet in soccer, it's crazy to me. I was at one of my A licenses I was renewing, and I won't say who the coach is, but it was one of the biggest men's teams in the country. And he knew, you know, when you go to do your licenses, everybody finds out real fast you're a goalkeeper. Because they say, get in my session. And he says, you know, I've got goalkeeping as a session. Can you help me? And I'm going, yeah, this is pretty basic stuff that you're being asked to be taught. And you know zero about it. It's wild to me that they don't know anything. So to then ask them to understand what we go through on the mental side is a tough thing, because that's what I liked about it, Ian. In fact, I wanted the game to be in my hands. PKs were my most exciting moment because I was never supposed to save it. I mean, nobody was ever going to blame me if I let it a PK. But if I came up with it, I was the hero and I wanted that game on my shoulders and I loved every second of it. I loved trying to psych that guy out. I loved, if I made the save, I think I owned them for the rest of the game. If I could get a PK in the first half that I saved, I'm pretty sure we were going to win this game, because I've just destroyed them mentally for the next 15, 20 minutes. And if we can get a goal in that time, I know we're going to win today. And it is such a mental, it's such a mental thing from two aspects, right? For people that don't understand. And one of them is staying focused. You know, we talk about why goalkeepers don't set on time. I think they've lost focus. They're thinking. Franz Hoop told me one time also, he said, a good goalkeeper never anticipates, always reacts. That the minute you start anticipating what you think is going to happen is the minute something else goes on. And now you've given up a goal because you already were sure that you knew what was going to happen, right? Miola comes to my mind when I say that in the 94 World Cup. Remember that? He was sure it was going to be a cross because the angle was impossible and it had to be a cross. And he went out and almost abandoned his goal. But it happens because we're trying to outthink the other guy. So from that and the, and I want to hear from you on that. And then also mentally from the, what happens when we do give up a goal, right? What happens when things don't go our way or when we make a mistake, right? A mistake, I'm sure you've had it happen, right? Where it slips through your hands and you go, how the hell? I've made that save 50,000 times. Now it slips through my hands. What did I do? And then how do I recover from that?
Well, there's first on the mental side of the coaches not knowing, that's such a massive thing topic we have to get better at. I'm trying to do it where I work. I'm trying to do it nationally. And coaches have to start understanding goalkeeping. And I remember I had this debate with an academy coach. I said to him, I said, receiving a back pass is mentally, not technically, mentally more difficult as a goalkeeper receiving a back pass than it is for a six. This guy started laughing. What are you talking about? Oh my God, I can't. And he's like, look what Ian just said. And I go, you didn't hear it. I said, mentally. I go, because mentally, we need to have that decision made. If let's say the player makes a back pass, the defender makes a back pass to the keeper from the corner of the 18, I'm on the corner of the six. The decision isn't made when it got to my feet because I can't turn my back, shield it, start dribbling, wait for support, go backwards. I have to go forwards or sideways. And he couldn't process this. And I go, I play it to the six. He has a player right on his back. He dribbles a little more. He turns left, waits for support, goes back, gets it back, comes around. We come out, we clear, whatever. And I go, he wasn't having it. He could not understand that mentally we need to make a decision very quickly. And you might get it and say, okay, I get it from my right, left back is on. And in my mind, I'm going to receive it. I'm going to switch it to left. In that time, the guy closing me, instead of going straight towards me, starts cutting off my left. So now left is blocked, right is blocked, and the ball's at my feet. Now what? And now I got to clear this thing 40 yards. So now you're expecting, there's so many things that go into the goalkeeping position mentally. And if coaches don't understand that, you're going to confuse the hell out of them because you're going to say, why didn't you play the left back? Or why didn't you play the six? But the coach that's watching this is with the pause button on the video. They pause the ball. They pause the video when the ball's at your feet and go, oh yeah, you should have played the six. Well, that's not when I have to make the decision because now I was going left, guy cut off left, six wasn't open when I had to make the decision. And if I have a touch here, so there's all these different things. And if they don't understand that, they're going to confuse the hell out of keepers. And we're also going to crush a lot of solid goalkeepers to the point of quitting or just being so unconfident, their performances will be terrible, you know? So coaches have to get better at understanding the goalkeeping position, you know? I see it all the time. It's a post that always, you know, comes up once in a while and it'll be wanted, looking for a 9-year-old goalkeeper that's good with his feet, great shot stopper, comes for crosses, aggressive, communicates, you know, all these things. And I always lie. It's a great post because it's ironically so true what coaches think, you know, and you have to give people time to get through that. You know what I mean? And then going into the mental side of the games, the style of training that I've developed over the years starts mentally and then it turns into a session. And what I like to do is create absolute chaos because, for example, there's a very experienced goalkeeper named Jaime Pineda. He played for us for LA Galaxy and kind of a national team keeper, played in 2 World Cups, plays for us. And we're playing a game in Seattle to go to MLS Cup final. It was a 2-game series. And we're playing a game and ball's moving around top of the box, passes. We're in Seattle, crazy game, big crowd, you know, obviously a lot on the line. And, ball's passed around and it goes passed out all the way wide, like full width of Seattle's pitch, which they have a really wide pitch. And he was kind of like, is his near post ball goes fully wide. And I'm thinking, okay, you got to drop a little central now. Cause it's fully wide. You can, you know, for the cross, and he stays at his near post. And right away I'm like, oh God. And I look and the guy that gets the ball out to his left looks up, there's Clint Dempsey on the far post. And this guy just floats across in. It wasn't even a great cross. And because Jaime was at his near post, the guy crosses it to like mid goal, maybe six yards out. He needs to drop 4 or 5 yards. He tries to jump, barely misses it, and Clint Dempsey scores. And I was like, oh man, okay, here we go. So long story short, we get to the following Monday and we do video, and I let him watch the play. I didn't tell him what I thought. I wanted him to see it, and I wanted him to tell me so I could see where his mind was, because you don't always want to tell your keepers everything. You want to see where they're at. So he looks at it, and he's like, oh, like this. I should have dropped off. And I go, yeah, yeah. If you were central, that becomes just a catch just above your head.
Right.
And so I go, why do you think you didn't drop? Because, I mean, you do this 100 times in training or whatever in a game, you know, and he goes, it was so chaos. It was like, it was crazy. I just forgot. And that's kind of just helped. That right there changed how I design my sessions. And what I, from that point on was, okay, I was like, okay, how do I create chaos to the point where there's 5 different things that happen before the pass across to me and I shoot, can you still set? But because we do those 3 or 4 or 5 things before, sometimes you forget to set because you're so focused on the previous things or something that might happen in the future, or, you know what I mean? It's crazy. So it's interesting when you design it that way and all the coaching moments that you can create. And that's what I try to do in my sessions, is create moments where I know they're going to mess up and then I can correct them. You know, it's not as programmed.
Yeah. And it is chaotic. And I always tell people that, you know, the reason why goalkeepers don't, you know, you might see a field player at 18, 19, make it in the Premier League. When was the last time I saw a goalkeeper at 18, 19, make it in the Premier League? I can't think of any. Maybe you can.
Yeah,
but tough. We need to see the weirdest situations over and over and over in match play. A striker gets so many more reps than a field player does. And, you know, we all know the Cruyff quote about average player only has the ball for 3 minutes. What do you do for the 87 minutes? Great. How much time do you think the average goalkeeper has the ball in a game? And if we need to see the weirdest stuff. I mean, I've literally seen a ball hit a gopher and get deflected. I rep that in training? How do I do it? I don't. I just need to see it. I need to see the weird, like you were just talking about, the cross. Well, what about a cross from this angle? Well, what about when they cut it back to the left, to the right foot, and now it's an in-swinger instead of an out-swinger cross? What happens when the guy can bend the ball this way or that way? What happens when the runners come in late instead of early? What happens when we can't pick it up and they're blindsided? What happens on the cutback cross? What happens, you know, all of these different scenarios that can be difficult to rep enough times in training sessions. We just need to see them in games, which means we may not develop until we're 24, 25. But on the other side, we tend to get a little longer careers too, because we don't get our legs taken out from underneath us every other game, and we don't have to put up with the nonsense on the field. Normally, we're kind of protected. Normally,
yeah. And like I said, that's where the sessions that I design. I have this one session. It's with multiple keepers. It's 4 keepers, because sometimes that's what I have at Galaxy or the national team, whatever. So instead of just, you know, one rep and you change, and, you know, I have everybody involved, and it'll be, you know, cut back cross to me, but I can shoot or I can pass it on to someone else. What do you do? And usually the first part, okay, they set, but then they set for me because I might shoot, but then I do it to someone else and then they forget to shoot. So it creates this, you know, not just one dimensional, but 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 dimensional type train. And then you do that and it goes straight into a cross, to a cutback, you know, to a header. And it's pretty fun and interesting when you do it. And like I said, the results are just, it's insane when you do it over and over. And like you said, it's an experienced position. And I remember I peaked around 27. I was athletic before, I was good, but 27, I was like, this is becoming a little easier. You know, it's seeing it and knowing, you know, just different variables that could happen and being prepared. So, you know, it's like
so,
a quarter.
So when you were growing up, when you were playing, okay, so you took off to, how'd you end up in Belgium? Let's just start there. So you're in Vegas, right? You're 15 years old, you said?
Yep. I was in Vegas age with my club team, the Generals, my buddy Aaron Griffith, and his dad was a coach. And we were watching the, might have been like the 82 World Cup, probably. Yeah, it was probably the 82 World Cup. And, or it might have been Mexico 86. I don't know. And the head coach was like, dude, I want to go to Europe. This is great soccer. He was watching like Belgium versus Argentina or something. He's like, man, I want to learn how to defend like the Belgians, because they just stopped, you know, Maradona. It kept them to one goal or something, I think it was, or, you know, whatever. So our team at age 12, we raised money, and we went over to Belgium, stayed with some host families, and we played like some games in Belgium and Holland and all that. And that was my first trip to Europe. And I remember just there was something about Europe that just, ooh, that was it. I wanted to be there. So the family I stayed with, we became really good house friends and friends with the family and everything. So when I decided to, at 15, I went to a camp with one of my then idols, Tony Schumacher. He was making an appearance, for this camp. And I was like, dad, I got it. Mom, dad, I got to go. I got to meet him, whatever. So we go to the camp, and, you know, after about 4 days, Tony calls me up. We're in this big stadium in Alabama. That's where the camp was. And he's sitting in like the 10th row, and he calls me up, and I'm like, oh dear, what's going on here? He's like, hey, you're very good. He goes, what do you want to do in football? Like, you know, I go, well, I want to be a pro. And he goes, you need to go to Europe now. And I was like, okay. Called my mom from Alabama. Hey, Tony just said I need to go to Europe. And my mom was like, all right, let's work it out. And so we called the host family that I stayed with previously in Belgium. And we were like, can he stay there until he, you know, and, you know, so I kind of knocked on some doors. There was a village that I stayed in that was like, you know, 60 people. And down the street was this other guy named Key Bunny, who at the time worked for the railroad station, but had a buddy who was a coach at Bruges. And he called that buddy and he was like, hey, can you come try out? And his buddy said, have him try out for the local team first, which is like a third division team. And let me know what they say. Like, is he, you know, so I tried out for that, like, you know, an hour, whatever. And that team was like, he's got a little something, you know? So then long story short, again, I apologize, but he set me up with Bruges on a Tuesday night, pouring rain, just put me through the ringer. And I can't remember like being like technically amazing, but I never gave up. And I think they just wanted to see mentally if I was tough enough. So after an hour, I took a shower, and after the shower, spoke to them, and they're like, yeah, let's bring you on. You'll be the third keeper of the 16 and under team. You won't play. You're just going to train, and we're going to see where you're at in a year. I was like, let's do it. And that's, the rest is history. I signed pro the following year, and I, you know, so a lot of hard work that, you know, working on my own afterwards. And that year I didn't play. I did not play. Even when my mom and dad came to visit me, over the Christmas period, we had a scrimmage game that I didn't play in. There was no like, oh, let's give Ian a game. Just his parents are here. No, it was all business. And then at the end of that season, there was a U23 tournament where a few keepers got injured, a few got sick. And the day before, they called me and they're like, hey, you got to go to this tournament in France. I was still 16. And this was like a 23-year-old tournament, like a, you know, like a reserve team. And I went there. We lost every game, but I played out of my skin, out of my skin. It was just unbelievable. So played that tournament, and I went from third keeper of the 16s, not playing, played in this tournament, to coming back. And they offered me a pro contract. I became third keeper of the first team in a year. So it was pretty amazing. And it just shows you what hard work and never giving up and determination and working on your own. I think there's something about working on your own, doing stuff on your own, that gets you in a mental state of mind where, I don't know, you're just, you know, you're doing stuff while others aren't, you know? And it's something that I stress to all my keepers. Go against the wall. The stuff you can do against the wall is absolutely amazing.
So true, man. It's so true. And yep. Every pro that I've talked to, and I haven't coached pro like you have at your level, but I spent a short time coaching pro, and every one of those guys I talked to talked about training on their own. And every book that I've read talks about training on their own. And I think it's one of the missing pieces that many of our youth have today, is that willingness just to go out. And I love the wall. I've got a story about the wall that I always tell kids. You know, it's like the wall, it should be your best friend. It Christmas Day, it's raining, it won't complain, it'll be there, you know, it never goes on vacation, it's always there for you. It's that puts it all back on you, right? How much do you want it? Because there's zero excuse if you can find a gymnasium or a tennis court, or there's a walls everywhere. Even a curb is a form of a wall. And there's no excuse.
There's two things: jumping rope and the wall. That was something that totally changed my game. If you can jump rope for 2 minutes a day, everybody thinks it's just for the jumping muscles. It's not. It's not. It's for that. That helps. But it's more the timing. We're going back to setting, and your brain is going like this. It's go, okay, I got to jump now. I got to jump now. So your brain and your feet start working together. Pass comes across. I need to set now. It's the same thing. You know what I mean? So your brain and your feet start working together, knowing when to set and how to get your weight transferred and balanced and all that. So I think it's important.
Right on. One of these days, do me a favor and set up a camera and film yourself doing a jump rope session. Kids don't understand how that's a balance thing too. Balance and timing and all of that. That's great advice right there, by the way.
Oh yeah. It's huge. It changed my game. And I know I'm planning on doing it. I'm planning on doing a video of everything I used to do against the wall, all the different drills you can do on your own, and then the jumping rope for sure.
I love it. Yeah. Somewhere on YouTube, we did a whole session with my son and we filmed him against the wall doing all this. If people can go to our SRUSA website, if you look at our blogs, it's 28 different things to do with a wall and the ball, a field player. But, and goalkeepers, there's so many other things you can do, especially if you can find like a racquetball courts are amazing. Because you can now envision that you're facing some way and the ball's coming from another way, and you can work angles. And if you tell keepers, just go insane and just smash it as hard as you can anywhere, and you don't know where it's going to come back. And there's all kinds of fun stuff you can do. You can be entertained for hours with just the wall and the ball.
Yeah. You do this with the galaxy keepers. We're fortunate enough. We have little futsal courts right next to our training fields. So we'll take the keepers in there, and it'll be just a lot of just footwork, like 60 against the wall with your right foot, 60 with your left foot, 60 right to left, 60 open up, turn, pass it, create an L, like those type of things, driven into the thing over and over, you know. So it's if you get creative, if you want it bad enough, you know.
So when you made the break, you ended up eventually in the Premier League, right? Was there a different feel to that than being in Belgium, and then especially because it was broadcast, you know, on such a broad level throughout the world that had never really been done before, I don't think, for one league to be promoted like it was, and people don't understand what that was like when that thing started. It was big. How did that feel? Was there more pressure?
Oh my God, yeah. Well, the pressure of being the first American keeper in the Premier League, the first American to sign in Europe, I think, you know, unless there was someone way back earlier. I signed in 87, I think, pro in Europe, and then I signed in 94 in the Premier League. So I think I was the first. I know that Keller was there with Millwall, but in the Premier League, I think it was the first. It was intense, and the pressure of not only just, you know, myself being in the Premier League, but also just as an American, like I was kind of representing America, you know, and I wanted to do that with honor and respect, and not only on the field, but off the field. You know, they all have a view of how Americans are, and, you know, especially overseas, we can have a bad rap sometimes because, you know, we're complete idiots sometimes when we travel. So I wanted to make sure we represented on both sides. The pressure was immense. And I remember, you know, my Premier League debut, I could barely tie my shoes in, you know, getting drafted. I remember I got drafted and, you know, I looked down, I'm like, oh, and I had to reset. Like, I was like, okay, I hope no one saw that. All right. Take a deep breath, you know? And then once you get on the field, obviously it, you know, once the game starts, it actually eases. It's all the buildup for me. That was more nerve wracking. But it was intense, and it was such an honor to do what I did, and you know, and to have people like yourself follow me from day one, and your son, you know, trying to do that. You know, I've had a lot of people say, you know, I want to try what you did, and I'm just like, that's such a fulfilling, you know, comment to hear, you know.
Now you didn't get a lot of opportunities to play for the national team, right? I think you played in the Olympics, right?
Yep, 92 Olympics.
And I know you had at least one cap.
Yep.
How is that different when you're representing your country?
Amazing. That was just an honor. I don't know why it says one. I had multiple. I probably had at least 10. One I played in, but I sat the bench a lot.
Right.
I just had some really good keepers in front of me. I had Brad Friedel and Casey Keller, you know what I mean? And you know, I think in a different era, I would have had a lot more caps, and they were in the system pretty early. So they were well known, and I was always kind of on the outside coming in.
And that's because you were in Europe, you weren't over here.
Yes.
Being worked with.
Yeah. And it's not to say I would have played over them. It's just, you know, they were great keepers, and how could I knock on the coach's door and say, hey coach, you need to play me over Friedel. And
right.
Even though in training, you know, I felt I was right there with them. I could never knock on the door and say, look, you know, why am I not playing? I mean, I understood why I wasn't playing. It's these two are some of the best keepers, probably in the top three, four we've ever had. So to be alongside that was awesome. And you know, the Olympics, I was there with Friedel. He played every game. And I remember the coach, Lothar Osiander, came up to me and he's like, Ian, he says, you've been amazing. I want to play you. I go, Lothar, I get it. I get it, man. I'm here ready for you. I get it. Brad's amazing. But hey, I'm ready if you need me. And let's just win this. It's, you know, so it was amazing to represent your country. Olympics was absolutely fantastic. It was probably the best month of my sporting life. Just everything about it was intense. It was awesome. You know, and to have that national team shirt framed, you know, was an honor. Wow. And, you know, like I said, I didn't get as many caps as I would have liked. But I think it was not so much the talent. It was just more the timing, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a different time in American soccer where we were just beginning, and the idea of training in residency and being together as a group and how the importance that the U.S. was putting on that at the time, and you being over in Europe definitely, you know, puts a hindrance in it. And people don't understand also that a goalkeeper has to have the confidence of their backs. Not that you didn't, but when you're training with the same guys every single day, and if the coach asks the center back or your captain, who do you think? And they're going to say, well, the guy I know the most. He's the guy I'm closest with. They're my friends. This guy I don't know as well. Not that I don't trust him. We know he's good, but it's just different. I think that's we've kind of grown out of that right now. As the national team, and now we're trying to find the balance of how do we get the guys to train together a little more often, being that the U.S. and Europe are so far apart, right?
Yep, yep.
Where do you see that going, Ian? How do you see us getting over the hump? Because it's not that we don't have top-level players now playing in top-level leagues in Europe. In fact, we've got more than we've ever had, yet at moments we still struggle. And I look at it as an outsider coach, not being on the inside, as a lot of this is the guys don't know each other that well.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I think it goes back to what I said before. We need a balance. We're going to be okay against some of the average teams, you know, but when we get to a World Cup and we have to play a Germany and a France and you know, an England and Belgium, I don't know if we're going to technically outplay them. Okay. I don't know if we're going to tactically outplay them. We're getting close. What we need to find is, can we battle? Can we find a way within the game? Because we can't always stop the game and have the coach tell us what to do. But can we, within the game, have players that can be soldiers out there and grind out a 1-0 or a 0-0 or whatever? And I think the balance of coaching has gone so tactical that we're losing the ability to, within the game, figure it out. And I think that's a major problem, not just, you know, in America, but in the world. I just feel that, you know, we're now waiting for the coach to, like, for example, corner kicks. When I played, we didn't have diagrams. We didn't have player, you know, coaches telling us who to mark.
Right.
If you were tall and there was a tall forward and you were a defender, you're tall defender, you marked the tall. Like, it was pretty common sense. Right. We had a guy near post. We had a guy, you know, just inside the six near post. We had a guy far post, and the rest is on, you know, match up. And they did it. You know what I mean? And now it's like there's 17 diagrams for each corner kick that the other team might take. And I'm just like, so what happens is you wait in your mind. All you're doing is the diagram. You're like, oh, well, I got my number. I got my player right here. But meanwhile, you didn't look behind you and see there's a wide open player and tell that guy to drop here and mark this player. You're like, nope, I'm doing my job. And so no one talks. No one, you know, and I hate to be like a negative. It's not all, I'm not saying it's everything, but it's just we're losing that individual creativity and that individual ability to figure it out on the fly. Soccer, football is a player's game. It's not a coach's game. Coach can do, you know, certain things. And that's what makes football the most beautiful game in the world. You have to figure out on the fly. You shouldn't be to have to be told you're winning 1-0 with, you know, 1 minute left to not play out to play out. Like, you should be dumping it in the corner, getting in the corner. And it's just like, we still have to tell that to kids. You know what I mean? And I'm like, those are the things we knew growing up. We knew that stuff, man. We knew how to just, like you said, it was old. It was just figuring it out on your own is going back to with our point in the very beginning. I feel very beneficial at times.
You know, one of the trends that we've seen in the last 5 years, and I think it's probably since Pep became famous with Man City, and that's everybody insists that we have to play out of the back, that this is the way you play the game. You must play out of the back. And what we're also seeing is even, boy, 10 years ago, the weakest teams in the Premier League were not going to press ever. You knew they were going to park the bus against Arsenal or Man United the entire game. You knew how were they going to play. And now we're seeing Southampton press. You know, you're starting to see teams come forward and put pressure on the goalkeeper because everybody knows they're going to play short out of the back and nobody's going long. And now we're starting to see the most insane goals that we saw once out of 10 years. You're starting to see them 10 times in the season. And that is top level Division I teams getting picked off of a goal kick or off of a pass back because they aren't even thinking about where the open player is, which is 70 yards down pitch. I mean, if you've got, you know, you've only got five of us in the back, maybe six if we count the six in the back. And if you see six on us, that means for sure there's somebody 100%. Open downfield because their goalkeeper's not marking anybody. So can we find the open player? What do you think about this trend? I've never seen so many short passes from the goalkeeper turn into goals ever in my life. And we've seen more this season and last season. It's crazy to me.
It's unbelievable. And the problem is the head coach. It's the youth head coach who wants to show off how well they play out of the back because it becomes about them, right? And if their keeper kicks it down the field because they're not feeling it, they get yelled at. Well, why'd you get like, should have played? I'm like, no, there's six guys pressing. That means you get it long. You're probably 1v1, 2v1, like, you know what I mean? And so again, there's the balance has just gotten so far tactical and so far egotistical that it then creates these moments. And I'm just like, Harry Redknapp was my coach at West Ham. And I remember this is, again, it was great coaching from Harry. He was like, big man. He goes, look, you're great at coming for crosses. I need you to come for crosses. I don't care if you mess up. I don't care how far it is. He goes, you come for this stuff. And he goes, if you mess it up, I'll have your back. Cool. Start coming for crosses. I'm playing some games. And I remember I'm doing really well on crosses. And then one game I come for a cross, mess it. They didn't score from it, but it was sloppy. And like, there was a scramble, cleared off the line, whatever. I'm not going to halftime. I'm like, dude, I'm going to get ripped. Comes up, puts his hand on my back. Hey, keep coming for it, buddy. Keep going. I was like, good coaching. Because the reward for me, you know, and it's the same for the back passes is you need to tell your keepers, hey, We like to play out of the back, but if you're not feeling it, I need you to do what you need to do. Kick it in the stands, kick it down the field, whatever. Then as a coach, if this becomes, well, this is getting stupid now, they're kicking it every time, then you readdress it. But if you don't give that freedom, I have keepers that I coach where they can't even kick a ball over 40 yards. They've never had to kick it far. I'm going, well, that's a problem. That's a problem.
Yeah.
And they've never thought, hey, you know what? They're pressing with six players. Let me put it over into the second line. But they haven't thought that because all they think about, it's their vision is this now. They can't do this because of how they're programmed to play. Because the coach wants to be that coach that is known as, oh, I play it out. Look at me. I play it out. Look at my tactics. You know, it's just all this, you know, whiteboard, you know, magnet stuff, which again is great. But if you don't have the balance, you become one dimensional.
So I guess we should touch a little on college soccer since it's inside college soccer. And you did spend some time coaching. You were at Pepperdine for a good chunk of time, right? And then Pepperdine, you were at USC.
Yeah. I did Pepperdine probably 6-7 years and then USC about 4.
Yeah. So, you know, having been coached by the pros and then coached in college and now coaching the pros, coaching at the national team, all the levels you've done, did you notice a difference in college with, I don't know, maybe it's the mentality of the players or maybe how recruiting was done or maybe the kind of player you were knew was going to be successful in college maybe was different than the kind of player who was going to be successful pro. But how can you contrast for our listeners maybe some of the differences between college and what it takes to be successful in college versus what it takes to be successful at the pro level?
Well, college is so condensed. I mean, the seasons are like 4 months. So you have to have a preseason. You have to have scrimmage games and all that within like a week or 10 days. It's crazy. So everything was just so condensed and quicker and just blah, blah, blah. Oh, the first game of the season's here. Okay. We haven't even worked on crosses yet. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
When I was at Pepperdine and USC, the women were just amazing. Like, I find women very, they're like sponges. They want to learn. I think the men's egos get in the way sometimes.
Sure.
I already know this. You know what I mean? And, well, we just played a game and you don't know this because you just let in a goal or you did that. You know what I mean? So it's different on that aspect. And they were just so much, they were just eager to learn and it was awesome. And, you know, so I had a great time at USC. We won a championship, national championship while there. Pepperdine, we were always, you know, right there close and they have a great program as well. And obviously the views at Pepperdine, you're training on this field and the, you know, Malibu's right there.
Right.
So that was fun, but you know, it's just more condensed. And I feel that as a country, if we can get to an 11-month or 10-month season, I think that'll only help, especially the men's side.
Yeah.
Because I know in Europe, when I was between ages, college ages, 17 to 21, when I was in Belgium, I was playing 40-plus games a year with the reserve teams, the 18, whatever it was, right?
Right.
And each of those games was intense. You had scouts at every game, you had fans, you had coaches watching from other teams, you had accountability, all those things. So you go 40 times 4, that's a lot of games. That's 4 seasons of 40 games. Okay. In America, we have those 4 years of college years. You maybe have what, 20 games max?
Yeah, maybe, right.
Maybe if you're a good team.
Yeah, and plus the playoffs, 20, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And of those 20, and we're talking a better team. Some of the lower teams don't make playoffs, so it's maybe 15 games. Of those 20, how many of them are really competitive?
Right.
So then you go, whoa, okay. Can we have a little, you know, longer season? Again, this is all financial. I get it. But I think that's when it'll really help the men's side. Because those games, over and over and over, go back to what we talked about earlier, is just the experience of having 40 games in a season compared to 15. It's massive. So by the time, excuse me, you're 21 years old in Europe, you've played, you know, 200-300, you know, games, and then you're ready to go to the next level. Here, we've played, you know, maybe 100 games. We're starting the next, you know, we're starting where they did at 17. So we're like 4 years behind, right. If that makes sense. And in no way, shape, or form is this putting the college down. What it is it's more, we need more of it. We need more of it. You know, it can't be so condensed because there's no real way to, and especially as a coach, how it's tough to even, you know, build a season. It's so fast. You know,
which is why coaches come to us as a company and they tell us we need immediate impact players because they don't have time to develop. Now, you know, you'll get into the spring, and in the spring, you've got a lot of time to work with your keeper. But in the meantime, we may not even have a job in the spring because we lost so much in the fall. We can't have that. It's retarding in the classical sense of the word, the development of the keepers. It's slowing it down to the point where, by the time they are old enough to play pro, they don't have enough experience to make an impact at the pro level. And it absolutely is hurting our game. And unfortunately, Ian, you and I have spent now, you know, between the both of us, probably 35 years around college administrators. And we know that this is never going to happen in the classical college setup where they're going to say, oh yeah, soccer is so important that we're going to spend all this extra time, effort, energy, money into a 12-month season or 11-month season or 10-month season because we care about soccer. Is just, it's never going to happen. And I think what, honestly, if I can speculate for a second, Ian, and I'm curious if you've even thought about this, I'm going to guess in the next 10 years, we start to see partnerships with MLS teams or maybe USL teams and colleges that we can find ways to keep these kids together and develop together into a longer season. But it won't look like the traditional college setup that we have now, at least on the men's side. It will look more like a full month season. I can see, you know, maybe the MLS decides to invest. Look, the colleges have amazing facilities, sometimes better than MLS facilities, and they have dormitories and food and all of the things that are a problem for a club the colleges already have in place. Yep. Why wouldn't the MLS say, go to a college and say, look, we're going to partner with you. We're going to invest this much in the coaching piece. You provide the facilities, and then you'll be our reserves team. You know, it's cheaper than a club starting their own reserve team, or at least maybe a third team, right? To do it like you would an under 23 and then the reserves and then the pro. This could be the best under 23 setup literally in the world because of the facilities that we have in place. I don't know. Nobody's talked about this per se. What do you think about that though?
I totally agree. I think there has to somehow become partnerships at the club levels, at the college level, and at the USL second division levels. Because, and the problem is egos. There's too many egos. There's too many. USL hates MLS. MLS hates USL because of, you know, no, this should be all partnerships. Academy teams that aren't MLS, let's say like a local club team, should be rewarded if a player goes to, let's say, LA Galaxy.
Right.
There has to be compensation. And I know there's some, but I mean, I'm talking more. So the academy then goes, I don't care about winning a championship. I care about getting this player to LA Galaxy, LAFC, San Diego, whatever it is. And then you get, you know, enough money to buy new balls, a new turf, a new field, all these different things. So your focus becomes development rather than I've had teams not allow their keeper come to LA Galaxy. I'm like, what? Like we have everything in place. From video, nutrition, food, we got everything. And it's, there's people, nope, he's mine, leave him alone, don't touch him. And I'm like, you train, there's 10 teams on one soccer field.
Right.
I mean, and I get it, that's the way it is, and you have to make it work. But if the kid has an opportunity, and I kind of get their side as well, it's like, well, we lose him, the whole team disintegrates. So there has to be this, you know, situation where they get very well compensated for a player that does transfer. And, you know, I think if we get that, that's when the men's side will really, really start to take off. The women's side's doing great. You know, the college works very well for their, that side. Again, things could be better as well, but when you have a couple World Cups under your belt, I'm not gonna be the one that tries to change that. They're good enough. But I think if we can get to the point where we do partnership with teams, and I know what happens when you go and play some games. I was at West Ham and I had probably one of the best keepers we've ever had, Ludo McClosco. He was a starter. I was the second keeper. I wasn't getting many games. I was the cup keeper. I played the cup games, you know? So I remember I went on loan, and what that did for me was huge. So if the players that, let's say, aren't playing can go on loan to a USL team, to a college team and all that. College is tough because of the rules. That's the only problem. You know, there's so many rules that don't apply to soccer, but they apply because a football did this or that. So they create a rule, but it has to go across the board. It's insane. So the college is always going to be a tricky one to adapt because all the rules, you know.
Boy, Ian, I think we will continue to grow. I think it will get better. I don't want everybody to think that we're all negative here on the system, but it doesn't mean that there's not room for improvement. If you said, I think I couldn't have said it any better myself. Well, Ian, I know you've got a big day here coming up, and I've got another podcast coming up. But again, tell people how they can find you. You've got your music, you've got your movies, you've got camps and clinics coming up. Tell us about your camp real quick. What do you do at camps? Why should I've sent a number of kids to your camp. I've got a lot of clients that I've introduced to you, and they flat out said, we learn a lot from this coach in our area, and we learn a lot from that coach. But the way Ian does it is different. I think every kid should. Goalkeeper should have to spend some time with you.
Thank you.
What do you do at your camps that you think you feel is a little different?
It's well, thank you for sending. Obviously, you've always been great. You know, throughout the years, I've just adapted my style based off what is needed, and they aren't getting enough game scenarios. They're not. They're jumping over things, and they jump over something and they run to their right and fly to their right. Well, you know where the ball is going, and I'm not knocking that. It's there's a time and a place for that. And
there's a time and a place. Right?
And of course that's more on the, so I see a lot of the camps where it's just a lot of agilities and I'm like, okay, that's great. Those are the things we can do on a one-on-one with your coach or with someone else, or, you know, in the gym or whatever. When you come to the camps, it's straight into game scenarios. You warm up on your own. I tell you, get here early, warm up on your own with another keeper. There's plenty of balls, plenty, you know, you can do your thing. When we start, and it's 2 hours of game-related moments. And
what age group are we talking about, Ian? Obviously, we say warm up on your own.
It's 10 to professional. So okay. What I do is I have five goals set up, five 18-yard boxes, and five scenarios each day. And it'll be themed. It'll be, let's say it's crossing and you know, free kicks theme. I'll have five different scenarios: a corner kick, a free kick, different types of crossing to finishing scenarios, and we create chaos. It'll be, you know, distribution involved with it. There'll be pressure on the distribution, you know, then goes into a cross, to a cutback, to a shot, to a this, and it just, I create as much chaos as possible with the hope of by the end of that day, it's not chaos anymore, and you can very quickly file in order of importance what to do. And from start to finish of one rep of the keeper, there'll be maybe 15 different moments that you have to try and get correct, from the back pass to a position, to a reposition, wow, cross, to a finish, to a rebound. And we have the other keepers as forwards and defend, like a 1v1 day. We have a defender, we have a forward. Can you recognize the defender's going to get there first? You drop off. They're not, you come out. And we create all these game scenarios that they never get to work on, except on the game day.
Mm-hmm.
We create them in the game. So again, it just gets them more prepared for making good decisions within the game. and people love it. And you know, like I said, it's something that just I feel very strongly about, that you have to create, you know, game scenarios within your sessions. There's the technical side in the beginning, you know, the warm up, the technical, and then once we get in goal, it's like I like to really create, you know, chaos. And there's days, especially at Galaxy, where we've done a lot of chaos, I'll bring it back in and do simple. Start middle, come across, we're hitting ground balls, dipping balls, you know, and simple. But it's the balance of that. And if you never do the game stuff, their only repetition is actually in the game, you know. So the camps are fun, and this,
so a
this
lot of contextual training. Then you guys can do a lot of in context of what would happen in the real game.
Yep. And my next camp, actually, this is the fun one. People look forward to this. It's December 27th to the 30th. I have it every year, and it's crazy when you get there. It's five goals set up. There's mannequins, there's all kinds of, you get there and you're like, okay, this is business. This is gonna be intense, you know. So
well, what a great Christmas present that a parent could give their kid coming to your camp during that break.
It's fun, like I said, and then I have great staff that work for me. They know their stuff. All the staff that are there, I've coached since they were, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, and they're, you know, they're out now in their mid-20s. So makes me feel old that I've coached them that long, but they're great. They know they know all my, and I kind of oversee everything. I walk around, I'll pull a kid and say, hey, you know, get your hands here, you know, so it's very interactive, massively. It's very positive. It's fun. And, you know, each group, what's nice is that, you know, it's five groups of, we try to keep it around six, you know, to eight keepers max per goal, per coach. And, the youngest group's like 10 to 11, you know, then there's another group. And then the oldest group is out. So you have these 10, 11 year olds doing the exact same stuff as the pros, you know. Of course, they're a little bit adapted. Maybe the back pass is a little closer. Or obviously the shots are softer and harder compared to which group, but you know, these younger kids are watching, you know, these pros and college keepers, and they're like, wow, okay, that's pretty cool. Look, we're all in the same. And then we come in, we talk about it, we go back out, come back in, talk about it. And, you know, I can teach them all the little intricacies that separate you from your competition, you know. And sometimes most of the time it's more about attitude, how you know, coach is talking, are you looking up and looking them in the eye, like little things, you know, that they don't quite know yet. So I love the camps, you know.
Right on. So they can find out more about your camp at infoyer.com?
Yeah, just go to the website. Just go to the camps page. There's a clinics camps page. There's a sign-up area. It's all pretty easy to do.
Do you still have room in your camp for coming up?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're gonna try to get this episode out really quickly. We'll get the word out to people. And you may have some people reaching out to you. And then your music. Where do we find your music?
Well, I have three Instagrams, funny enough. Ian Foyer, okay, which is my one. Ian Foyer Music, which is my music one. And then Ian Foyer Movies. So, yeah, we can, you know, the movie one is, I'm going to be, once the movie goes to DVD, not DVD, like Netflix and all that, I can post some of the scenes I did, like behind the scenes stuff. So it'll be kind of cool if you follow.
Cool.
And then the music, I try to do all kinds. It's more like up-tempo party music, that, you know, whatever. So it's fun. Little side project.
Yeah, right on. Well, hey, man, thank you so much for coming on it. We've been at this. That was a good hour and a half, man. Yep. We did good. I really appreciate you sharing with us. And you and I will talk off the air again soon. And sure. I love it. Thanks, man. You become a friend, and I really appreciate you coming on with us and sharing your experience with our listeners.
Always here for you, buddy. You're amazing.
Thanks, brother. All right. We'll talk soon, Ian.
Thanks, guys. See ya.